This is the second part of our story of Oliver Twist. Now let's go on. In the meantime, at the Brownlow house, all went well, and Oliver was given a complete new suit, cap, and shoes. One day, a friend of Mr. Brownlow, called Mr. Grimwig, came to call. Oliver had gone to return some books for Mr. Brownlow. He was to pay the £4.10 owed the bookseller with a £5 note given him by Mr. Brownlow, and to bring back 10 shillings in change. "He'll be back in 20 minutes at the longest," said Mr. Brownlow. "Well," said Mr. Grimwig, "I don't expect him back. The boy has a new suit of clothes on his back, a set of valuable books under his arm, and a £5 note in his pocket. He'll join his old friends, the thieves, and laugh at you." Oliver was walking along when he was startled by Nancy, whom he had never seen before, screaming out very loud, "Oh, my dear brother!" And he had hardly looked up to see what the matter was when he was stopped by having a pair of arms thrown tight around his neck. "Don't," cried Oliver, struggling. "Let go of me. Who is it? What are you stopping me for?" The only reply to this was a great number of loud lamentations from the young woman who had embraced him. "Oh, my gracious, I've found him. Oh, Oliver, oh, you naughty boy. Come home, dear, come." "The devil's this?" said a man, bursting out of a beer shop. "Young Oliver! Come home to your poor mother, you young dog. Come home directly." "I don't belong to them. I don't know them. Help, help," cried Oliver, struggling in the man's powerful grasp. In another moment, he was dragged into a labyrinth of dark, narrow courts and was forced along them at a pace which rendered the few cries he dared to give utterance to unintelligible. Oliver was taken to a house on a filthy street where the Dodger, Charlie Bates, and Fagin waited. Oliver's £5 note and the books he carried were taken by Fagin. "They belong to the old gentleman," said Oliver, wringing his hands. "Oh, pray, send them back. Send him back the books and the money. Keep me here all my life long, but pray, pray, send them back. He'll think I stole them. Oh, do have mercy upon me and send them back." Oliver jumped suddenly to his feet, uttering shrieks for help. Fagin, taking up a jagged and knotted club which lay in a corner of the fireplace, inflicted a smart blow on Oliver's shoulders and was raising it for a second time when Nancy, rushing forward, wrested it from his hand. "I won't stand by and see it done, Fagin," cried the girl. "Let him be, or I shall put that mark on some of you that will bring me to the gallows before my time." Oliver was sick and weary, and he soon fell sound asleep in Nancy's arms. One day, shortly after this occurrence, Mr. Bumble, the magistrate of the workhouse, sat himself down to dine and read the paper. The very first paragraph upon which his eye rested was the following advertisement: 5 guineas reward. Whereas a young boy, name Oliver Twist, absconded or was enticed on Thursday evening from his home at Pentonville and has not been heard of, the above reward will be paid to any person who will give such information as will lead to the discovery of the said Oliver Twist or tend to throw any light upon his previous history. And then followed the name and address of Mr. Brownlow. Mr. Bumble, in something more than 5 minutes, was on his way to Pentonville. Upon arrival, Mr. Bumble commenced his story. There were sad hearts at Mr. Brownlow's that night. Oliver remained locked away for many days at Fagin's house. Then he was released, but seldom left alone. He was placed in almost constant communication with the Dodger and Charlie Bates, who played the old game with Fagin every day. At other times, the old man would tell them stories of robberies he had committed in his younger days, mixed up with so much that was droll and curious that Oliver could not help laughing heartily. In short, the wily Fagin had the boy in his toils. At the behest of monks, he was pushing the lad into a life of crime. Having prepared Oliver's mind by solitude and gloom to prefer any society to the companionship of his own sad thoughts in such a dreary place, he was now slowly instilling into Oliver's soul the poison which he hoped would blacken it and change it forever. The days passed, and one night Fagin held a meeting. Nancy was there. It was decided that a certain house in Chertsey was to be robbed. A small boy was needed to help in the robbery, and it was decided that Oliver was to be that boy. "Once let him feel he is one of us," said Fagin. "Once fill his mind with the idea that he has been a thief, and he's ours, ours for his life." The night of the robbery came, and when Oliver found what he had to do, he pleaded, "Oh, pray, have mercy on me, and do not make me steal." But steal he must, and they put him through a lattice window. Suddenly a noise was heard. Scared by the sudden breaking of the dead stillness of the place, and by a loud cry which followed it, Oliver knew not whether to advance or fly. The cry was repeated. A light appeared, a vision of two men at the top of the stairs, a flash, a loud noise, and he staggered back. Someone had him by the collar before the smoke had cleared away and dragged the boy up. "They've hit him! Quick! How the boy bleeds!" Then came the loud ring of a bell, mingled with the noise of firearms and the shouts of men, and the sensation of being carried over uneven ground at rapid pace. And then the noises grew confused in the distance, and a cold, deadly feeling crept over the boy's heart, and he saw or heard no more. Later, Fagin heard the story of the robbery that failed. "They fired and hit the boy. We cut over the fields at the back with him between us. They gave chase. The whole country was awake and the dogs upon us. They were close upon our heels. We parted company and left the boy lying in a ditch." Oliver awoke in the morning light and staggered on, creeping almost mechanically until he found a road. He saw a house which perhaps he could reach. Pitying his condition, they might have compassion on him. And if they did not, it would be better, he thought, to die near human beings than in lonely open fields. As he drew nearer to this house, a feeling came over him that he had seen it before. Yes, Oliver was back at the house where he had been wounded. Inside, the servants were nervously describing the previous evening's thwarted robbery, each assuring the other of their common bravery and derring do. But when a knocking came at the front door, they started violently. The cook and the housemaid screamed. When they summoned the courage to answer en masse, they beheld no more formidable object than poor little Oliver Twist, speechless and exhausted, mutely soliciting their compassion. They no sooner saw Oliver than they lugged him straight into the hall and onto the floor thereof. "Here he is," bawled one, calling up the staircase. "Here's one of the thieves, ma'am. Wounded, miss." "Hush, pray," said a young lady's voice from the stairhead. "Wait quietly one instant while I speak to my aunt." She soon returned with the direction that the wounded person was to be carried carefully to a room, and that with all dispatch someone was to fetch a doctor. Dr. Losburn finally arrived and treated Oliver, after which he went to the ladies of the house, Mrs. Maley and her niece, Miss Rose, with the suggestion that they view the thief. Upon entering the room, instead of the dogged, black-visaged ruffian they expected to behold, there lay a mere child, worn with pain and exhaustion, and sunk into a deep sleep. Oliver finally awoke and told them all his simple history, although he was often compelled to stop by pain and want of strength. Oliver's pillow was smoothed by gentle hands that night, and loveliness and virtue watched him as he slept. He felt calm and happy. Oliver's ailings were neither slight nor few. In addition to the pain and delay attendant on a broken limb, his exposure to the wet and cold had brought on a fever, which hung about him for many weeks and reduced him sadly. But at length he began to get better and was finally up and about. Mr. Giles, the butler, did all he could to make Oliver feel at home. One day, Oliver turned to Miss Rose and said, "I was thinking that I am ungrateful now." "To whom?" inquired the lady. "To the kind gentleman and the dear old nurse who took so much care of me before," rejoined Oliver. "If they knew how happy I am, they would be pleased, I'm sure." So one day, Oliver and Dr. Losburn set off by coach to visit Mr. Brownlow and his caretaker, Mrs. Bedwin. But the house was empty, as Mr. Brownlow had sold off his goods and gone to the West Indies 6 weeks before, taking his housekeeper and his friend Mr. Grimwig with him. So 3 months glided away, 3 months of true peace and happiness. Oliver Twist had become completely domesticated with the old lady and her niece. But throughout this period, Monks had been lurking in the shadows. He was determined to find Oliver and turn him into a criminal. And find him he did. Immediately, he went to Fagin to work out a plan to get the boy back in their clutches. Nancy, who had been carefully watching his comings and goings, was able to overhear their plotting. What she heard drove her into a frenzy of anger and fear. She sought out Miss Rose, and an arrangement was made for them to meet on London Bridge between the hours of 11 and 12 on a Sunday night. In the meantime, Oliver and Miss Rose discovered that Mr. Brownlow had returned from abroad, and they went to see him. Mr. Brownlow, Mr. Grimwig, and Mrs. Bedwin were overcome with joy at seeing Oliver again. Miss Rose discussed her visit from Nancy with Mr. Brownlow, and it was decided that he would accompany her to meet with Miss Nancy at London Bridge. It was a very dark night. The church clocks chimed 11:45 as Nancy emerged from the shadows. She had taken a few restless turns to and fro when a young lady accompanied by a gray-haired gentleman approached her. "Not here," said Nancy hurriedly. "I am afraid to speak to you here. Come away, out of the public road, down the steps yonder." Nancy then proceeded to tell them the terrible story of Monks. "He is tall and a strongly made man, but not stout. He has a lurking walk, and as he walks, constantly looks over his shoulder, first on one side and then on the other. Don't forget that. His eyes are sunk in his head so much deeper than any other man's that you might almost tell him by that alone. His lips are often discolored and disfigured with the marks of teeth, for he has desperate fits and sometimes even bites his hands. Upon his throat, so high that you can see a part of it below his neckerchief when he turns his face, there is..." "Yes," cried Mr. Brownlow, "a broad red mark upon his throat like a burn or a scald." "How's this?" said Nancy. "You know him?" "I do," said Mr. Brownlow, "and he'll rue the day when I catch up with him." And catch up with Monks Mr. Brownlow did. By a coincidence which seemed to be controlled by a hand stronger than chance, it developed that Mr. Brownlow was the dearest and oldest friend of Monk's father, and he soon came to realize that the young lad Oliver was this same friend's long-lost second child. Mr. Brownlow had kept abreast of the sordid and unsavory events of Monk's life and was able to locate him. He confronted him with what he had learned, and Monk's admitted that Oliver was his half-brother and entitled to the large portion of the huge estate that his father had left. For the painting Oliver had seen and loved in the bedroom of Mr. Brownlow's house was of his mother, and also the sister of his other dear friend, Miss Rose Maley. And so the fortunes of those who have figured in this tale are nearly closed. The little that remains to their historian to relate is told in few and simple words. Monks continued his life of fraud and knavery, and at length died in prison. Mr. Brownlow adopted Oliver as his son. Fagin was eventually caught and hung. As for the artful Dodger, he may have died as far from home as did the chief remaining members of Fagin's gang, but Master Charles, appalled by Fagin's fate, decided that a life of crime was not for him. And now, in closing, I would summon before you once again the joyous little face of our orphan, Oliver, who, tried by adversity, remembered its lessons in mercy to others, and gave fervent thanks to the good Lord who had protected and preserved him.